Hello and welcome to the latest review edition of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thanks again for joining us. In a weekend of missed opportunities for the likes of Tottenham, Manchester City and Newcastle, we have a full set of games to discuss, as well as previewing four midweek games. In order to do that, I'm joined by Kristen Henaj and Karthik Krishnayar. And gentlemen, what we'll talk about today in section one, we'll talk about the top four and the championship games. We'll talk about the relegation battle and we'll update our listeners on other leagues in section two. And then finally in section three, we'll talk about a couple of games that had very little bearing on the table itself, but some interesting games, and we'll preview the midweek game. So let's start with section one here, guys. Let's start with the early kickoff on Saturday, Norwich, Manchester United. A very poor game to watch if you were, if you're a neutral or if you were some poor Manchester United supporter out in California having to wake up at 4:45 a.m. for this. Very poor game. Martial was injured in the build-up and Rashford was rested, and that resulted, Karthik, in very little attacking outlay from Manchester United.
Yeah, I was actually quite thankful. I had been at the Orlando Red Bull game the previous night and had gotten home very late, drive back from Orlando, and had an assistant with me. So I was hoping that the 7:45 a.m. Eastern time kickoff, 12:45 BST, would be a game that woke me up. But in reality, it was back to sleep. But it was a good win. And I mean, I guess a resourceful win for Manchester United away to a team in Norwich that you would think would have been, given their circumstance and their situation on the table, a little more aggressive. And we've seen now Norwich in the last few weeks really play very defensively at the Emirates and finally concede a goal. And then in this game, a terrible defensive error, terrible mistake by Bissong, undid some very good defensive work. But again, sitting deep, playing without the ball, at home, when you need a result, for as much time as they did before the Mata goal and the great Rooney move, is going to doom you. So I guess I'm just very disappointed that Norwich is going down without a fight. They're going down with a whimper.
Chris, one of the players that was the talking point of the Louis van Gaal change last summer, when van Gaal finally had a whole summer to bring in players that arguably he wanted, was Memphis Depay. And Memphis has basically had two really good games in a Manchester United shirt. One was in the Europa League, and the other one was a game away at Southampton around Christmas. And I'm wondering, in this game, I personally thought he was very poor in this game, and I'm wondering what you think of Memphis Depay's first season at Manchester United.
It's been a struggle. It's been a real struggle for him. And I think it's partly the adjustment period. Obviously, Arsene Wenger says that it takes about a year for a player to adjust. I think, in fact, Man City's head of recruitment said similar, that it takes that adjustment time. And I've actually written on that issue in itself for Yahoo recently. I think what you have to remember with Memphis is he's an exceptionally direct player. And if you watch him in Holland when he was with PSV, he would run at the opposition quite consistently. I also think he was in a very different style of team, in the sense that the likes of Jorginho Wijnaldum, who was there, other players would create space for him. And I think if you're expecting him to go one-on-one and beat his man consistently, when essentially there's not a great deal of space around him, you're going to be disappointed. He's not someone, I think, when I look at him, that is a real complicated trickster as a winger. I think actually he's about quick turns, quick movement, and exploiting a defender's poor positioning or lack of balance or that kind of situation. And it hasn't worked for him. And I think a large part of that is because of the setup that he's been provided, which hasn't been the smoothest of transitions for him from the Eredivisie.
Karthik, talk to me a little bit more about that. I think Chris raises some good points there. A player like Memphis Depay, who, as Chris pointed out, was the spearhead of the attack when he was at PSV, comes into a team, a tactical system, where he's not anymore. And I guess we can make the same arguments about Angel Di Maria and a lot of other players who have come through with Van Gaal. So at the end of the day, how much of the blame should we place on Memphis here, and how much should it go back to the fact that Van Gaal is not getting the best out of almost every player that he signed?
Well, I think Chris has made some very good points about Memphis. He's a direct player. It takes time to settle in this league. I think maybe too much was put on him right away when he signed. And that, remember, they didn't sign Martial until the deadline
last day.
So,
yep.
Yeah, a lot was put on Memphis that first month of the season. And I think clearly he was thrown in at the deep end. And then as Martial was signed, and then Rashford began to emerge, and you saw that Lingard could play various roles for this team, he was given a greater chance to acclimate. But then what that also has done is it's just kind of blown his confidence. So we'll see next season. I mean, I think, again, he's a guy Van Gaal wanted, and we don't know who's going to manage Manchester United next season. But there's a strong possibility. There were a lot of cases in this league of guys not acclimating at first and then kicking on after year two or three. A great example this season is Eric Lamela at Spurs, mm-hmm. who was seen as a 35 million quid bust, of the biggest signing in terms of transfer fee in Spurs history, was seen as a complete bust his first two seasons at the club. And I think this season he probably hasn't gotten the credit he deserves for how good he's been on a very good Spurs side. So sometimes coming from other leagues in Europe, and we know the jump from the Dutch league is quite dramatic. There are a lot of players who do settle, but there are others. Classy is another guy at Southampton that we had huge hopes for this season. Dutch player that hasn't exactly lived up to that level of expectations. So I think it's a bit early to write off Memphis, but again, he was very poor in this game. He's been very poor for the most part this season.
Yeah, Memphis is still in the danger of becoming the next player to be hit by the curse of the number 7 shirt since Antonio Valencia left it. Since Cristiano Ronaldo left United, we've had Michael Owen have that shirt, Antonio Valencia, Angel Di Maria, and now Memphis Depay.
Sense that's part of the problem, though, in some ways, is that, again, you're putting, not you specifically, I mean, the entire Manchester United organization, everything, is putting that pressure on a young guy of, you have the number 7 shirt, do it. And I acknowledge the argument of pressure produces diamonds, all this kind of thing, and he needs to be tested in that way and grow to the next level. I do question, though, just how much help he was given in transitioning. And actually, if you look at the players that do succeed, Kartik touched on Lamela. Of course, he's had time. He's also had the benefit now of Mauricio Pochettino, who, as well as being a compatriot, is someone that understands what he needs. And I just question if Van Gaal understands what Memphis needs, because he does have this approach with young players where it's throw them in the deep end, and the ones that sink, sink. The ones that swim, then I can take credit for.
Yeah, I think you guys have made some great points and points that I agree with. I think Van Gaal's handling of young players is not as great as people believe that it is. Let's move ahead, guys, and talk about the West Ham versus Swansea game. Chris, when you and I were doing the preview, we were talking, we were discussing Payet and talking about how well West Ham has done in certain situations, along with Mark Noble as well. This game, this result was a complete surprise to me. West Ham had a lot more to play for, but I thought Swansea just ripped through the West Ham defense on multiple occasions. Mikel Antonio, who I think has been a very good player for West Ham this season, was guilty for multiple, maybe up to 3 of those 4 goals. So, Chris, your thoughts?
It's so difficult with West Ham because, again, it's that notion of being consistent. And you look at some of the games they've lost this season, they've tended to be against teams they really should be beating. I remember they came to St. James's Park and I was there, and I fully expected them to win quite comfortably. And actually, they were really tepid and really poor. And it highlighted the notion that actually Dimitri Payet is so central to them in an attacking sense that if he's either not feeling it or you can nullify him, then you're going to stop West Ham doing a lot of damage. And in relation to this game, actually, I thought it was the defence that let them down. I didn't see anything of the West Ham stability and structure at the back that I'd seen in previous weeks. And I think that is what will stop them getting the Champions League this season. But I think, again, you have to contextualise it with the expectation of the start of the season. There was an uncertainty about Slaven Bilic when he arrived. Certainly he'd done a lot at Besiktas, and there was those who were fans of him. I can remember reading just as many people saying that he would tank and things would struggle and it would go south for him very quickly. So they've achieved a lot this season. I'm sure West Ham fans will be disappointed, though, to leave the bowling ground, because I think that was the last game, wasn't it, at the bowling ground?
Right. Manchester
United game is.
Yeah. It's a penultimate game.
Thankfully, they have the opportunity to at least leave on a potential high with that. But I'm sure they'll be disappointed that they haven't been able to secure that top four.
Karthik, talk to me about Swansea, because I can picture the gaffer sitting here wondering why we're not talking about Swansea some more, given that they just beat West Ham 4-1. Why is it that a team that has the likes of Gomes and Ayew and Baloshi and Sigurdsson and Key has struggled to put up good performances consistently this season? I know we've talked about some performances that have been pretty good from them this season, but in general, they have underwhelmed.
Well, let's just first give them praise for this match, because I was telling actually my assistant that I mentioned that went with me to the Orlando New York game the other day that Wayne Routledge is a player that was always an underwhelming player until he got to Swansea, and then you've got other guys like Joe Allen, and we're going to talk about Joe Allen later in the show because he scored a goal today for Liverpool, but guys like Joe Allen, Scott Sinclair, and others, or Wilfred Bonet, who've been Michu, who've been outstanding in Swansea system. Sigurdsson, who was outstanding for Swansea, left, hadn't done as well, came back, and it's been great. Barini's another one that was better at Swansea than anywhere else he's been. That there's something about the club maximizing the potential of players, and that kind of faded this season for some reason. But then in this game, we saw Routledge get that opening goal, play really, really well. I thought, and I think he's been playing well, better of late. And these last 2 weeks, Swansea's been rampant. Key was good and very influential in the midfield. He's been in and out of the team this season. Gomes has been frustrating, but he still does a lot of things other than score goals that are useful. And I know the gaffer is listening. He may want to discuss this with me offline, but there is a value to Gomes, and there's a value to Gomes, particularly in a game like this when you bring him on late, and he came on late for Wayne Routledge, and you've got teams on the ropes, and you can just really go for the sword at that point. So Gudelin has made an impact now, finally, on this side. We've seen a really confident, almost swashbuckling team these last 2 weeks against Liverpool and West Ham. They weren't playing Norwich and Newcastle. They were playing Liverpool, and now at the Bowling Ground against West Ham, who have been one of the stories of the season. And I guess we'll do a bad game, because even that run of draws they had, I thought they were the better team in each of those four games, including the draw against Leicester, the eventual champions. So they were due a bad game, but it wasn't that they had a bad day at the office. Even though they were due one, they couldn't get into the office. Swansea was so good in the first 20 or 25 minutes of this match. So I know that might be kind of a weak analogy, but the point I'm trying to make is I think the last 2 weeks you've seen Gudelin's work. He had some health issues after he came over to England from the Pozzo family of clubs. Maybe now he's tempted to stay. Maybe he's tempted to continue in this role. Otherwise, Swansea's going to have to make a decision about manager, if they want to bring Brendan Rodgers back or if they want to go another direction. I think Rafa Benitez, given their style, is probably a poor fit, but maybe Gudelin will stay on in the job. Certainly based on the last 2 weeks, I would give him the opportunity to if he wants to.
Chris, Gudelin took over when Swansea were, I think, just 2 points above relegation back in January. You see him staying at Swansea after this? I mean, Swansea's had a great list of managers recently. Maybe Francesco Gudelin takes them into another era where they can maybe even try for Europe next season?
I think with these kind of situations, I always try and take a little bit of an insight from what's being reported. And the fact that there's been talk of Brendan Rodgers coming in, the fact that those reports don't seem to go away at any point, that makes me think that the club or someone inside the club is allowing those reports to continue, if that makes sense. There's no one saying that it's complete tosh. I also think that someone like Gudelin, in the position that he's in, and also not just his age, but his health as well, it feels as if the summer would just be a good separation point for both. He came and he did what was asked, the job was completed, they've survived actually quite comfortably. They've also got a good signing in Alberto Palocci as well for next season. then it's the point to just cut and give someone else a try. Perhaps Brendan Rodgers, who knows? The man, I think, is still to be decided in that sense. But I don't see it being cast iron. I actually think that come the start of next season, Swansea City will likely have a different manager at the helm.
All right. Yeah. Udogie turned 61 this October. So, his health issues are something that we have discussed. Let's move ahead and talk about the health of Everton as a football club. They played Leicester City, the champions, this week. Leicester, of course, the big talking points was the championship, the trophy presentation, Andres Bocelli playing, singing before kickoff and all of that fun stuff. It was a Jamie Vardy party and a party all over Leicester City. But for me, as we talked about, Chris, before we in the preview, the big talking point was Everton. Here was a chance for them to show that they can hang with the big boys, but they were absolutely, they were just abject in this game. I know Vardy scored an early goal and that set them on the back foot, but even past that, Lukaku looked like he didn't care. Barkley tried to influence the game, but he struggled. Another very poor performance and kind of drives home everything Karthik has said, doesn't it, Chris? You notice, Karthik, how I didn't go to you on that one.
Yeah, I my views of Roberto Martinez are well established. We'll let Chris have this one.
I think actions speak louder than words in the case of Everton, and the actions of the Everton players are not a group desperately fighting to protect the manager. They seem a lot more self-motivated in that sense. And again, as you put it in your sort of question there, they were abject. That's the best way to describe it. And they have been for a few weeks now. They've really not looked any different. And that's with all the reports and with everyone saying that Martinez has to go. That's when you would imagine if the players did really care for the manager, they would up their work rate, if nothing else.
Right.
And yet they've been lacking in quality and work rate. And again, I've said elsewhere that for me, the Roberto Martinez situation at Everton is really starting to parallel the one at Wigan, in the sense that there might be nice moments, nice interchanges, but can they get the job done? There's an interview with Toby Alderweireld in HLN, the Belgian sports paper, in which he said that at Ajax he learned how to play football, at Atletico Madrid he learned how to win games. And that's my issue with Roberto Martinez, is it's a lot of theory but not much achievement, in the sense that, again, the FA Cup was great. It's just one day, it's one moment. Over a sustained period, I've not seen him achieve a great deal. If anything, I've seen lots of pretty stuff with not much end product. And again, when he moved to Everton, the consensus was better players, better results. It just hasn't been the case. And I strongly believe that come the summer, with this new investment that Everton have secured, you'll likely see Roberto Martinez told he can depart the football club.
Karthik, anything to add to that what Chris has said?
No, I think it's been very clear for a long time, and I love the analogy Chris brought about Alderweireld. He learned to play football in Diego Simeone's system, which is defensive, organized, and you're accountable to your teammates. There was no accountability at Everton. There was no accountability at Wigan to your teammates, because everybody was taken by the smooth passing, the smoothness in the media of the manager, and his ability to articulate his principles around football, but the results have been abject. Look, at Wigan, they stayed in the league for several years by drawing games. Let's not forget that. And by having teams, even in their region of the country, Blackburn, Bolton, Blackpool, others, that were having financial difficulties and went down before they did. And they were being kept in the league by those sorts of factors. He comes to Everton. They have a strong structure and organization and shape always under David Moyes. And Moyes never had the budget to spend. I mean, for years and years and years, he had to go with guys like Victor Anichebe up front, because he would have to take players on loan because they didn't have the budget to go out and get guys and take guys like Royce and Drenthe, just kind of roll the dice. Play Timmy Cahill as an out-and-out striker, as a number nine at various times. Play Fellaini in a more advanced role because he didn't have the guys the transfer budget, Osman on the wing. I mean, he used to do all kinds of creative things tactically with his team, even though for some reason Moyes got the reputation of being a very boring manager versus Martinez, who would bring this style to Everton. Well, those fans, and there were a lot number of Everton fans, they might deny it now, but who thought that
David Moyes had run its course, and look, we need something that can take us to the next level. We want to play. We want to watch good football. Well, you got your wish. You're watching open, entertaining football where your team is shipping goals and chances constantly. And that's what's happened the last two seasons at Everton. The first season, which was an inherited team from Moyes, and couple nice additions that you have to give Martinez credit for, Deulofeu, Lukaku, and others, elevated them that first season. But the last two have been as poor as Everton has been since they were fighting relegation under Walter Smith. So I think the time is up, and I love the analogy Chris brought in about Alderweireld, because you wonder about John Stones now. Where is he going to learn his football? Where is he going to learn to be a proper footballer? He's not going to be the kind of center back we saw Alderweireld perform at the level he did this season at Spurs, unless he gets a proper manager who can teach him defensive tactics and accountability to teammates at Everton, unless he's moving this summer, which he very well could be.
Yeah, not only at the managerial post, I think there will be huge turnover at Everton personnel-wise. I think Lukaku will be gone almost certainly. Very likely that Barkley and Stones will move on. Of course, in Stones' case, his transfer, his level of transfer, the amount of money the team earns for him will be substantially less than what Chelsea were ready to pay for him about a year ago. We're not going to really discuss Leicester, because the big talking point about Leicester is when we analyze the season as a whole, which we'll do when we do a season review in a couple of weeks. So let's go ahead and move on to the Tottenham-Southampton game. Karthik, I'll stick with you here. A huge opportunity missed for Spurs at home to extend the lead away from Arsenal. Southampton have hit some good form, and last week we talked about how they may or may not be next season's Leicester City. But the big talking point here is definitely a capitulation by Spurs, especially after they took the lead early in the game.
Yeah, again, third straight match where Spurs have taken an early lead and given it away. The West Brom game, which basically handed the title to Leicester. Then the Chelsea game that confirmed Leicester as the champions. And now this match, which has opened the door for Arsenal to catch Spurs. And look, Spurs have had a great season. They wanted to win the title. But I think for so many of their supporters, it's a psychological thing. You just want to finish ahead of Arsenal when you've had this sort of season. Now they go to St. James Park next week, perhaps needing a result to stay ahead of Arsenal, quite likely needing a result to finish ahead of Arsenal, and you don't know what's going to be on the line for Newcastle in that game. A very difficult ask. They put themselves in a bad position. Real quickly, I know we might not want to address this, and this is going to get us a lot of nasty mail. I feel the FA, and Dembele would have missed this game anyway. Okay, I think a ban was in order. Three games would be fine. I think the FA has set a very poor precedent by suspending Dembele for six matches when they only suspended Fellaini for three.
Hmm.
And I know that's a view shared by some other writers in the UK, some other people who cover the sport. But Spurs now are staring down the barrel of a gun for next season. The first month they're going to be without Moussa Dembele, and you see how kind of open they are in midfield when he doesn't play. There's a lot of stuff we don't notice that he's done this season. Keeping the ball moving, keeping things tidy in midfield, covering when Dele Alli makes those, and of course, Halley's also had his disciplinary problems, but makes those surging runs. And those sorts of things that we'll be missing for the first month of next season. And the first month of the season is other than these last three games, represents the gap between Leicester and Spurs this year. So they don't want to get off to another bad start. So I just want to register my disappointment in the FA's kind of very subjective administering of justice. Dembele should have been suspended, but again, there was provocation. Everything had kicked off in that match. I'm not quite sure why they chose to make an example of him and not of Fellaini in the Leicester Manchester United match, or Costa. Maybe they've suspended Costa so much they don't want to give him another 6-game ban. But I was disappointed by that.
Chris, talk to me about that subjectivity. Fellaini gets banned for for an elbow after Robert Hood pulled his hair. But we all know Fellaini is very guilty of that. Pretty much every game he elbows someone, even as a Manchester United supporter and a defender of Fellaini in general. I find him to be abhorrent at times with his elbow. And then you have this situation here where Dembele gets a much longer ban.
I don't have a conclusive answer. If I'm plucking one from the air, I I think possibly because he's attempted to gouge an eye, which is a bit more of a serious attack in the sense that it could blind someone. Whereas, again, an elbow, for the most part, while a nasty thing to do, undeniably, is probably not as serious in terms of the damage it could do. That's the honestly only theory I have on the whole situation, as terrible as they both are.
Yeah. The irony being, like, with the discussions on concussion and stuff, some might argue that an elbow to the head or the face is maybe slightly even more dangerous than an eye gouge. But like you say, there's no way to understand why the FA does what it does. So let's maybe leave that conversation there and move ahead to the big game from this weekend, which was Manchester City, Arsenal. And Karthik, I'll come back to you. Huge opportunity for Manchester City to almost guarantee that United were not going to be making the fourth place. But now with the draw, and we get into the game, but talk to me about the repercussions of this result first.
Oh, it's just a culmination of City's poor play since the middle of September. And the repercussions are that Manchester United has the door open. They control their own destiny. They can win both matches and get in. They get into the Champions League for next season and potentially save Van Gaal's job. They can also take 4 points and potentially get in based on where Manchester City is going next week, which is to Swansea. We've just gotten done talking about how well
Gooding is. They can also win just one game and go through. Yeah.
Right. Correct. Yeah. Yeah, so they and their final game is at home against Bournemouth, who have effectively shipped the season in since they got to 40 points and are not really playing very good football of late. Right. So, I think that this is an absolute stunner to folks, because there has been a narrative out there that Manchester United is struggling and going through this terrible season, whereas with Manchester City, even though I had sounded the alarm bells months ago, I know a lot of people just think I'm fatalistic because it's my club, but there were clear signs that things were going badly, and nobody really jumped on to talking about how poor City was until really the last 6 to 8 weeks. And now City's in a position where Pep Guardiola may start in Europa League. That having been said, I don't think it's a complete disaster. I mean, part of me thinks, given that there was this ridiculous level of expectations around Guardiola coming, being in Europa League may make it easier for him to focus on the Premier League, understanding right. English football, and not having to worry about Europe. That's one train of thought, and one that I'm actually not, I don't want to say I'm wed to, but I'm seriously contemplating. It might be a good thing.
Chris, the come from behind draw, led from a goal from Sanchez, some brilliant interchange. I think the game kind of changed once Walcott came on, when Walcott came on. But in general, Arsenal didn't look that good. I thought City were the better team overall, personally. I think Karthik might disagree, but, not a great performance from Arsenal, but did just enough, especially given the Tottenham result, to get the result that they wanted away from home.
Definitely. And I think it's vital for Wenger because, again, he's chosen to define himself by that top four inclusion throughout his career. It's been the explanation for why trophies haven't been as consistent at the football club. So to potentially lose that would be huge for him. I think it would make his position untenable. To be truthful with you, in terms of their performance, I didn't see anything that was too brilliant. Obviously Jack Wilshere is back, which again I imagine is a big boost for them, potentially for England as well, whether you think he should be in there or not. Personally, I don't think he should. I think his injury record is not nearly as far behind him as it needs to be for me to trust him in a tournament. You have to put his talent aside, I think, at this point and look at just how much he's played. I just think Arsenal do need a little bit of an overhaul in the summer.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that we saw these stories about Walcott being allowed to leave, about Oxlade Chamberlain being allowed to leave, because again, they're the sort of players that when we talk about him showing too much loyalty to the wrong individuals, they're some of the culprits, I think, in the sense that, again, I admire him very much for investing in two very young players, because that is a crapshoot, to borrow an American term. They haven't delivered, and there comes a point where you have to accept that they're not going to deliver, and that's not an easy thing to do, because it's essentially swallowing your pride and accepting that you've made at least one mistake in purchasing them in the first place. they need to go out and they need to start buying quality now. I think that's the big issue for them, is the idea of buying quality for tomorrow is great. Mm-hmm. It also needs to be supplemented by buying quality for the here and now, because that's what will elevate you. And you could also argue that's what will raise the level of those players with that potential.
I'm really disappointed about the Wilshire thing, honestly, to hear this week. And I have a great deal of time for Roy Hodgson, as I know Chris does. But guys like Mark Noble, who can't get a look from England, who plays a similar role to Wilshire, Danny Drinkwater, who's been brilliant this season for the league champions, Leicester City. Those are two guys I would take, especially given that they've stayed fit this season, over Wilshire to a major tournament. I mean, this game is quite a shock to me. And now that Danny Welbeck is injured and appears like he will miss the Euros, which is a blow for England, maybe that's an additional spot they could use. They don't necessarily have to go like for like with another attacking player. Maybe they can include a Drinkwater or a Noble or someone like that.
Yeah, especially we also know that Ox is out as well. So that's another attacking position that's opened up. And honestly, Sturridge is just one sprint away at any given time from being injured again. So injuries are starting to hurt England, as they are Belgium and as they are many other teams. Suspensions are hurting France. So the Euros will be interesting in terms of what players actually end up missing out. Karthik, I want to stick with you to give me your thoughts on, I got a chance to watch Pellegrini's speech, his last game at the Etihad. And I have got this sense from many City supporters, not you, but many City supporters, especially on the wonderful world of Twitter, who have been very dismissive of Pellegrini. And, I think that echoed in the fact that the stadium was at best 50% filled when Pellegrini gave his farewell speech today.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed for our club, honestly. For these supporters, I think a lot of them are front runners. Even the locals in Manchester have become front runners because of the whole bitter thing. We've been called bitters for years by United supporters. Right. It rings true here, because we've now become front runners in the same way they are, complaining about little things, not appreciating accomplishments of a manager and someone who's given three seasons to the club and has delivered three major trophies to this club. Mm-hmm. Three trophies in 3 years. That's a good return.
Right.
Especially given our history, that's a great return. And there has been a consistent effort by so many in the Manchester City supporters community to blame Pellegrini for all of the problems this season and just say, well, we've got the best manager in the world coming in. It's going to be completely different next year. There are structural issues with this side. There are problems with the director of football not buying properly and refreshing the squad properly. There have been the impact of financial fair play. There has been a lot of injuries, although other clubs have had a lot of injuries too. But there's just a lot of factors here. And I think Pellegrini has been somehow able to, at times when Manchester City's players had checked out this season, been able to get one more good performance out of them, time and again, including today, right? I mean, I'm lamenting the result because it's a culmination of many months of inconsistency and poor play. But yes, Manchester City, I agree with you, was the better team today. Pellegrini's always been able to get that one more performance out of this side because the players and those who work at the football club genuinely like this man. I'm not sure they'll genuinely like Pep Guardiola. They might have it all of him. I'm not sure they're going to genuinely like him. They didn't genuinely like Roberto Mancini.
Right.
So, you know, a year from now, we could be having this conversation about how criminal it was of Manchester City to have treated, to have undermined Pellegrini and the supporters to have treated him with so much disrespect. And I think we probably will be having at least some of that conversation. I was just appalled by it. I have to say that.
No, I think you're right. And I think any reasonable City supporters would agree with you, because I remember, six years ago, Manchester United supporters still having the famous clock at the stadium that celebrated the fact that City hadn't won anything in over 30 years. And now we're at a point where City are at least on the pitch, stronger than Man United. And I feel like a lot of those City supporters have very quickly forgotten what has happened in the interim and are expecting things that maybe they shouldn't be expecting. All right, so we'll wrap section one up with that conversation. And when we come back for section two, we'll really get into the details of the relegation battle, some very interesting and, well, let's just say some very surprising results in the relegation battle. So we'll be right back with section two of the World Soccer Talk podcast. The two games that we're going to discuss in Section 2 will be Sunderland's surprising win over Chelsea and Villa's, I would say again, surprising draw with Newcastle. Both these results were not what I had predicted. Maybe Chris, when we did the preview, was a little bit closer to predicting these results, especially the Newcastle one. I was even looking at the goal difference, whereas Chris was being more had a better head on his shoulders. So Chris, let's start with the Villa Newcastle game since we are talking about that. Like I said, I thought this was a game that Newcastle would win and maybe even win by a couple of goals, but it did not play out like that. Newcastle were the better team overall, definitely. But other than maybe a couple of chances for Mitrovic and that one clear-cut chance for Colback, didn't create a lot of clear-cut chances themselves.
Yeah, you saw a microcosm for the season in that sense, that when they needed players to score big chances, they just couldn't do it. It was right. The same in the reverse game at St. James's Park, that between Sim De Jong and Mitrovic, they had really good chances. De Jong's in particular was one of arguably the most bizarre misses you'll see this season. They couldn't put it away, and consequently they're now the only team in the Premier League that hasn't beaten Aston Villa this season. There's the most damning statement for why a football team is being relegated, I think. It's also what you have to remember is that, and I can't explain the foundations of this, Aston Villa and Sunderland have a very weird relationship in the sense that they both take immense pleasure in seeing Newcastle suffer and struggle. Sunderland, of course, totally understand. You can read reams and reams about that. Why Aston Villa takes such pleasure from it, I genuinely have no idea. They obviously relegated Newcastle last year, in 2009, and had the big sob on the Tyne banner, who's your next Messiah, Ant or Deck, who were two kind of TV presenters from Newcastle, quite famous in England. Again, they did similar. They chanted Sunderland a lot. They showed a lot of Sunderland shirts, and it's just a bit bizarre. I mean, again, I can't fully understand it, but to borrow what Andros Townsend said about Crystal Palace last week, I think Aston Villa came up to try and relegate Newcastle. And fair play, you could argue they've just succeeded in doing that. But I'll never truly understand it, which is much to say as Newcastle themselves didn't do any favours because they had chances and didn't put them away.
Karthik, talk to me a little bit about this game as well. From my perspective, other than the few chances that Newcastle had, Villa actually created a little bit in this game. We obviously don't have to get into too much of the details with Villa because we don't know what their squad is going to be like after this summer. But talk right. to me a little bit about this game.
Yeah, I guess we all had a good pop at Julian Lescott a few weeks ago when he said that the players would be playing freer because of relegation. Yeah. Maybe it just came out the wrong way. This is why sometimes tweets, and I know better than just about anyone how dangerous tweets can be. I've had a few doozies in my time also, but
usually like to Villa discuss played... near a cosmos, but not usually the
right. Yeah, I think Villa has played actually with more freedom. I think the Westcott's correct. Since they've been relegated, they don't seem to have the pressure on them, I guess is what he was trying to convey. And in this game, and actually he was one of the really good players in this game. Mm-hmm. They look seem well organized. Newcastle, which it seems so energetic. And had been pushing the last few weeks under Rafa Benitez in a way we had not seen them under Steve McClaren since the very early days of McClaren's tenure, just fell flat in this match. And you're right. I mean, I thought Villa seemed very comfortable, seemed very good value for this draw. So I don't know. There are some weird relationships between the Midlands and the Northeast. I mean, the Coventry-Sunderland one is another strange one through history where no club has done more damage to Coventry and to Sunderland than Coventry, and I think Coventry not being in the top flight of English football anymore might be the reason why Sunderland now is on their longest run of staying in the top flight in the post-war era. I mean, and I know we're going to get to their game in a minute, but it looks like it's going to continue.
Yeah, another player that was really good was Kieran Clark. I thought he had an excellent game, some great last-ditch efforts. It was a kind of performance from a player that came through the youth ranks that you would have expected to see earlier on this season. But anyway, credit to Kieran Clark. Chris, let me ask you this. This is something that you, Karthik, and I wanted to discuss last week, but I failed as my duties as a host and forgot to ask this hypothetical question. We were discussing what would have happened if Benitez had taken over earlier. And I think we were all in agreement that Newcastle might not have been in the position they are in right now.
They wouldn't be, exactly. And again, it's all hypotheticals, it's all ifs and buts and that sort of thing. I think what you can say is that the form would have been significantly better, because you just have to look at the way they're playing now. They're much harder to beat. They're actually keeping consistently more clean sheets. I don't think personally they were even remotely troubled against Aston Villa. I would say they were a little bit more lucky in the Swansea game. You could say maybe similar about the Palace game. But much like with Sunderland and Sam Allardyce, they've become harder to beat. And I think if you give him those games, the ones particularly, I think it was one against Stoke, there's one against Bournemouth at home as well, games that are potentially winnable, because Bournemouth, I think, are incredibly inconsistent, then you have a much greater potential of staying up. The problem was, and the problem I think will always be at Newcastle until the ownership and those at the top end of the front office realise it, is they think they always know best, and they always try to wait until the very last minute to do something. And the problem is that if you wait until, say, there's 10 games left, it's not enough time for a new manager to change things to the point that needs to be. It's the same with, again, allocating more funds in January when you've tried to skimp through by spending the bare minimum. That's the issue with Newcastle. It's the bare minimum consistently. It's bare minimum with the recruitment in terms of how much they spend. It's the bare minimum for even silly little things like how much they afford to the media team's budget. So Newcastle, to give you guys an insight, has one of the smallest media teams, I would argue, in the top few divisions. And credit to them, they work frighteningly hard, knowing them as I do. Even then, there's only so much that the two men can do, which is essentially how big the team is. And it's those little things that then all culminate into this giant bubble of the players don't have a relationship with the fans, because I've long advocated that actually the best way to build that relationship is through your media channels, through interviews, that kind of stuff. It means that when things get tough, they really don't care for them that much anyway. So it's such a convoluted issue in that sense that I just have so little sympathy for the likes of Mike Ashley and Lee Charnley, because they put themselves in this position consistently. They keep thinking they're smarter than the industry, yet they have next to no experience in that industry. And it's frustrating to watch from a fan perspective. It's laughable to watch from just a neutral's perspective. And I hope that the summer they actually start and think, we need to change. It can't be everyone else's fault that we're in this position 6 years on from the last time.
Yeah, I think I agree with a lot of what you said. I think Mike Ashley... Yeah. Go ahead, Karthik.
Oh, I was going to say, well said by Chris. I've heard from Chris and others that have covered Newcastle, all of those complaints, and I think that read like a manifesto of a journalist who covers Newcastle United, and as the fan and Chris that grew up a loving Newcastle mm-hmm. United, and I would urge everybody to listen to that, because it is a club beyond the football pitch that has serious structural problems, a serious problem at the top, and relegation is probably a good thing for the club because of all of these things. Unfortunately, I mean, that's the cruel reality.
Yeah, that's too bad, because I really did think after this week we would be talking about how Sunderland is going to get relegated. But guys, they managed to beat Chelsea in a game that for a majority of the game, a lot of the game, I thought they had no way that they would win this game. A huge 3-2 win over Chelsea. Karthik, I'll come to you first. First of all, that Kaziri goal is one of the goals of the season.
It was
absolutely magnificent. What a volley out of the top drawer, left foot, top corner, brilliant. But let's start with Chelsea first, Karthik. The player that I think has been missing for a majority of the season that I think was the star of last season was Nemanja Matic. And I thought in this game, for all of Chelsea's success attacking-wise, I thought he was the best player on the pitch for either team.
Yeah, I can definitely buy that, and I was happy to see him have a good game. It's been a while. I think his confidence was shot by the time Mourinho got the sack, and then Heating came in and decided he was going to play Mikel in that role, and that stabilized things because Matic was being asked to do things that were unnatural to his game by Mourinho when things started to go bad. So I'll buy that. On Kaziri, I just want to point out that while Big Sam went to the Tottenham and got him and the creative spark that he's been, Newcastle spent similar money on or more money on Jonjo Shelvey. that if you just want a reason why we're talking about Sunderland probably staying in the league again and Newcastle getting relegated, they, you can even just look at those two transfers right there, head to head.
One thing I would say is that I think something that both Sunderland and Newcastle did in January was they identified what their squad needed. And so I appreciate the comparison you draw, but I also think that Newcastle needed someone like Jonjo Shelvey to pull the strings. Where I think Sunderland were much smarter was that they assessed how those players would fit in with those around them and what they would need for those players to succeed. So if you take Lamine Kone, for example, big physical defender, very brutish, perhaps not the greatest technically, not someone that could really start things from the back. You go and you buy Jan Kirchhoff instead, someone who can do that and complement Kone in that sense. With Newcastle, the signings were made, yes, they had addressed problems, but if you're going to play Jonjo Shelvey, you need someone who's highly energetic to play alongside him and to essentially cover for the lack of ground that he refuses or can't make up. That's where I think Sunderland were very smart in their business, in the sense that, yes, they'd done their due diligence on these players and that deserves credit. But I also sensed that in buying the players that they did, the likes of Kasri, the likes of Kone and Kirchhoff, they knew what else was needed to make them successful and how they would benefit the overall team. And again, it just goes back to the notion of having a plan, which Newcastle haven't had for a few years now.
Go ahead,
Craig. That's a great point. And I think Big Sam, he had a couple of months coming in October to kind of assess the squad, and he figured out what they needed. I think Damon Doi is a player he thought would actually help them a little more than he has. But it did motivate Defoe and Borini to once again find their form. And then the other three signings, Kirchhoff, Kone, and Kasri, have all been upgrades and have all fit in well and kind of adapted to English football very quickly. We talked about with Memphis Depay, sometimes there's an acclimation process. I think Allardyce identified players that he thought would fit in with their squad and fit in the physical nature of English football better than maybe some of the other targets. So, look, I've been touting Sunderland for weeks, saying that they were going to get over the hump. And then finally, when I began to lose faith, which was last week, right? I've been saying for 3 months,
yeah,
Sunderland, that there wasn't really a relegation fight. They were going to get out. Allardyce had them well organized. They would have to just turn some draws into wins. And when I finally said, you know what, I think they're finally going to go down, they turned in this performance. But I think the most important thing, and maybe Chris can speak to this as someone who's covered the team closely, the fighting spirit that Allardyce has instilled in this team. There are so many matches where they've looked dead, where they've looked beaten, where they've come back and gotten a late draw, where they've come from behind and gotten 3 points like this match, or even if they've lost, they've gone down fighting. I think this thing might be over on Wednesday. And I know we'll preview that game in a little bit.
Yeah, I think those good points made. So basically, Karthik, it is your fault that Newcastle are going down. I think I agree with that. I think I give a lot of credit also to Defoe and Borini. Defoe, we know, has been magnificent for Sunderland this season. I think that was goal number 14 or maybe 15 even for him. He's been excellent the last few games in particular. Almost single-handedly has been able to keep them in the relegation battle as opposed to getting relegated. So big credit there.
We have to start talking about Defoe. He hasn't been on the right clubs, right? Because he was at West Ham and he was at Spurs and he was at Pompey for a little bit now. Sunderland, we have to start talking about him as one of the great strikers in Premier League history.
Absolutely.
Honestly.
Absolutely.
Look at where he's been and look at how many goals he scored and the circumstances and maybe the players around him. I think historically we have to have maybe a different assessment of this player than many had during his playing period.
I definitely agree with that. I mean, I think the one black mark he had against him was some of his performances in his second spell at Spurs. I think that's what counted against him. Even though his goal ratio was very good, this was the 2009 to 2014 era Jermaine Defoe. I think some of his performances let him down. And then, of course, what happened at Toronto, where people expected the world of him. And his goals ratio was decent, a goal every other game. But some of the other stuff let him down. But I totally agree with you. And I think even at 33, Karthik, I think we'll be talking about, if Sunderland does go down, I think Defoe will be the first player that's snapped up by another team because he guarantees you goals. So I agree with you. All right, let's update our listeners on the rest of the leagues around Europe. A comfortable 5-0 win for Barcelona over Espanyol keeps the Catalans at the top of La Liga. A surprising loss to bottom of the table Levante meant that Atletico's title challenge is as good as over, as they find themselves 3 points behind Barcelona, but with an insurmountable goal difference. Real Madrid, however, did manage to beat Valencia 3-2 after a late surge by Valencia couldn't cancel out the goals by Cristiano Ronaldo and Karim Benzema. Real Madrid are a point behind Barcelona going into the final game day, and their goal difference is now further in the favor of Barcelona. So really, Real Madrid will need to win, and Barcelona will need to lose realistically for Real Madrid to win the title. In Bundesliga, a win over Ingolstadt for Bayern meant that they are 8 points clear of Dortmund, who lost by a goal to 15th place Frankfurt Eintracht. And a 1-1 draw with Brighton, and I think a lot of our listeners already know this, meant that Middlesbrough will be joining Burnley in the Premier League next season. Brighton, on the other hand, have a chance to yet be promoted as they join the playoffs against Hull, Derby, and Sheffield Wednesday. The initial round of playoffs will be played May 13th to 17th, with the final played the finalists playing each other on May 28th. And before I get to Serie A, really quickly, Chris, Karthik, your favorites for that playoff. I'm going with Hull City. Chris?
Yeah, I think Hull City as well. I think they did something that not a lot of teams are able or wise enough to do, which is they held on to the better component of their Premier League plays and didn't lose a lot of them.
Karthik?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with Hull as well, but Derby is still dangerous if you look at their squad. They've just underachieved this season. So of the four teams, they're probably the most talented side. Hull, they'll have the most experienced side. Brighton under Chris Hughton have had the best season. Unfortunate for them. This is one of those seasons I wish there wasn't a playoff. They should just take the top three teams,
right?
Because the gap between Brighton in third and right. Hull or Derby or finished fourth was pretty massive.
Yeah. And then finally, at the time of recording, Serie A has Napoli winning and champions Juventus losing at halftime. And those games will wrap up by the time we finish recording this podcast. When we come back for the final section, we'll review the rest of the performance, rest of the results in the league and do our previews. We'll be right back with the final section of the World Soccer Talk podcast. We're going to start this section with a little bit of a conversation that our listeners will want to hear. In the last section, we were talking about Sunderland, but we didn't bring up the conversation about DeAndre Yedlin, U.S. men's national team player, who was involved in this game and had an assist. Depending on who you ask, it's an assist, but it was a deflection, really, that led to the goal. So coming to you, Chris, as someone who's watched both Newcastle and Sunderland closely, and we'll come to Karthik after that. One of the things that you said before we started recording is something that I feel very strongly about, which is that every time one of these players, Yedlin, et cetera, especially Yedlin, I feel, has any sort of even a halfway decent performance, it's a little bit blown out of proportion. So let's start with that framework.
Yeah, I think that you just need to give them more space to grow. It feels a little bit like an overprotective parent, that when they achieve something, it's then given an exalted status. I think certainly for DeAndre, it's been an interesting season in the sense that he had that moment in the derby where it's his foul throw that leads to the equaliser. He's done well to recover from that, though. And I think in general, he's even talked about it himself, that he's learned a lot from Sam Allardyce from a defensive perspective, which if we look at Yedlin's career, that's always been
right.
The issue, realistically. It's not his issues going forward. It's only ever what he's doing when he's in his own penalty box.
Yeah,
I think for his long-term trajectory, he's not going to really succeed at Tottenham. That's the problem.
At Sunderland, yeah. Oh, you mean he's on loan, right? Right now from Sunderland?
Right, yeah. That's my concern, is that right now Tottenham have a very settled side. And again, they have two great fullbacks in Kyle Walker and then Kieran Trippier behind them, both vying for that one spot. You put someone in there again who I think still needs more games. I can see it going one of two potential ways. He'll either be someone like Andros Townsend or someone like Harry Kane, in the sense that I think he's going to get a lot of loan spells while he's with Tottenham. That can be the making of you, in the sense that it was with Harry Kane. It can also mean it's impossible for you to ever build continuity at your parent club like it did for Andros Townsend,
to the
point where they just end up selling you.
Same with Zeki Friars, who came from Man United to Tottenham.
Yeah, we've had a lot of guys like that. You know, Ryan Mason was loaned out 7 or 8 times, and he's finally kind of settled. Simon Dawkins, who's now a DP here in Major League Soccer, was loaned out several times by Spurs and never did settle. In fact, he was loaned out to MLS at one point. So you're right. I think the Kane versus Townsend analogy is very good, and it's a matter of which way it's going to go. I think it is just exciting to see that he is able to crack a Premier League lineup and consistently play for a manager as demanding as Allardyce. Although it should be noted, Allardyce had concerns about him, which is why Emmanuel Abouy was signed,
right?
After having not played for a year. And then it turned out there was this situation with Abouy where he's now been banned for football for a year because of a non-payment to an agent. I must admit, I have some sympathy for the player in that, because I have to say, and normally when those things happen, it's the agent who's being a thief or a shark or something. But nonetheless, he was banned. So then they had to ride out the season with Yedlin, and it might be of great benefit to both the player and to the U.S. men's national team program.
Yeah, I think what you guys have said is absolutely right. I remember being doing World Cup interviews on different radio shows back in 2014, and we were talking about Yedlin with exactly the same analysis, which is that he's terrific going forward, has pace to burn, has a trick or two, but it's beyond that defensively, especially if you're going to play him as a fullback, there's a lot for him to improve on. So I think that is fair. Let's go back to talking about the rest of the league's results. We'll start first, Karthik, with you, with a Palace-Stoke game. Charlie Adam popping up to score a goal after an excellent pass by Arnautovic. You and I have talked about Alan Pardew and the fact that Palace has struggled at home, especially throughout the season. This was a pretty awesome result for them.
Yeah, now we have to start raising questions about Stoke. They're the team that's really in a tailspin. I'm not sure if folks have noticed how poorly they performed the last month and a half, and shipping goals and just looking lackluster at times. So questions about Sparky. I mean, this is a team that seems to have they've hit a wall, or perhaps even regressed it in the latter part of the season. But important result for Palace. You didn't want them going into that FA Cup final against Manchester United at Wembley, having lost or drawn their last however many league matches. So a good result for them, and they'll push on. Their eyes are on Wembley, obviously.
Yeah, the big player that I think Man United will be looking at is Bolasie, who was terrific in this game. Excellent run from him. Just a kind of direct...
Well, I saw today Leicester linked with Bolasie. That would be a good one with them going into Champions League next year.
Yeah, that's a good shout for sure. Let's talk, Chris, about the Bournemouth 1-1 draw with West Brom. Not much at stake for either team. Last week I talked about how frustrated I get when I see Evans playing at left back, and on cue he produces an excellent cross that led to the Rondon goal, as well as another cross that almost led to another goal for West Brom. So good performance from West Brom, from Evans in particular. Your thoughts?
West Brom are essentially WD-40. They're not pretty, but they're effective. And I don't think they'll ever get relegated under Tony Pulis. I also don't think they'll ever improve drastically or grow under Tony Pulis. That is essentially the quandary you're left in when you hire him. And I think, again, we've talked before about this, is why it tends to go sour for him, is that eventually people tire of just surviving. They want to thrive as well. And again, you talk about the likes of Rondon who've come in, and to go from playing in a Champions League team to playing in a team like that must be very difficult for a player, because again, they're not the most creative in midfield. They're staffed by essentially 11 piano carriers, whereas normally you're supposed to have a few piano players in there as well. And he's tried. I mean, he's bought the likes of Stefan Sessegnon. The problem with Stefan Sessegnon is that he's inconsistent, notoriously inconsistent. In fact, it's haunted him at PSG. It's a big issue for him at Sunderland as well. And it just means that, again, they're grinding out results. And I never felt they were in trouble of being relegated when they had that bad form. I also was never kind of thinking of them as having this late season resurgence and playing some beautiful football. They'll get the job done. That's what they'll always do. And I think for a team like West Brom that as recently as the last sort of 5 or 6 years was a bit of a yo-yo club, I imagine they just appreciate the stability more than anything, even if the fans themselves aren't too fond of it.
Yeah, another player that had a terrific game was Artur Boric. Saved a penalty, saved a long-range effort from Gardner. So a good result for both teams, gets them both a point. Let's talk about Liverpool-Watford, another game with little bearing on either team's future. Liverpool really are looking ahead to the final. And as we talked about with Watford, Even though they had a good result last week, they struggled in this game. The goal came, Karthik, from an old school football, almost like, what's a good analogy? I guess Crouch last week scored a goal like this with Stoke, knocking down Tarnautovic. Same thing with Benteke playing down to Joe Allen, who scores, a rare goal in his Liverpool career. The Welsh Xavi is back, Karthik.
Yes, and of course he played alongside the English Xavi at Swansea, Leon Britton. But yeah, everybody who plays in the Swansea side's a Xavi. But this showed a little bit of the value. Benteke getting the start. Origi is injured. They're hoping to have him back for the Champions League final. Certainly Belgium is hoping they have him for the Euros. But Origi is injured, and Sturridge, you know the situation with him. So and Danny Ings has been out forever now. Benteke gets a very rare start, and you see some of the value he brings. Now, that is not the way Jurgen Klopp wants to play,
right?
But it's useful. It's one of those things where there was this talk he wasn't getting goals. When he finally gave way to Origi in the starting lineup in January, late January, early February, he was getting some goals. He just was a misfit tactically for the other things they were doing off the ball. And this is, I think, another example of what he can do if you play to his strengths. As for Watford, Kiki Sanchez Flores playing out the string, I think he's done a very good job this season with that team, but we know how the Pozzo family is, so the chances of him returning are about as good as Roberto Martinez's chances of returning. He'll be replaced, and we could be talking about Watford being relegated next season. I think it's a mistake to let him go, but all indications are, and given the history of their ownership at their various clubs, that he'll be gone.
Chris, Norwich plays Watford. Let's go into the previews here. Norwich plays Watford midweek. Norwich has a lot more at stake here. They still have a chance. It's a very, very slim chance. Very slim chance to stay in the Premier League. But based on what I saw against United, it doesn't even seem like they are really up for it. There wasn't a lot of drive at United. I think we talked about how poor United were, but Norwich themselves didn't look like they really cared. So very sad. And honestly, I'm going to say this is probably going to be a draw, right? Norwich Watford.
I can see it being that it's not a win to Watford. I think the problem for Norwich is they had that victory against, I believe it was Newcastle, where they were kind of in the strongest position, and they just didn't capitalise on it. They picked up a few bad results. They also lost to Sunderland, which, again, if you're losing the games against your rivals there,
right,
there's a strong chance you're going down. And, you know, I find it very, very interesting to see some Norwich fans talk about the ambition of the club and the lack thereof it, really, because, again, they bought Tim Closer in January. They bought Mbakani, or loaned Mbakani, sorry, in January. And that's the issue with Norwich, is that actually, if you look at their summer business, there wasn't a huge amount. And I think part of the problem was that last time they came up, they famously bought Ricky Van Wolfswinkel for about $8.5 million, which, right, I think was their most expensive purchase ever, or club record. And they kind of got their fingers burned with that one a bit. And he didn't pan out the way he was supposed to. So, again, it's my opinion. I just sense maybe a little bit of trepidation in terms of going back to that European market and investing heavily in players, because you're not entirely sure what you're getting. The problem with that is, if you don't take a risk, you're unlikely to get a reward off the back of it. And that's what we've seen with Norwich, is they've given opportunities, could even parallel Arsenal in that sense. They've given opportunities to players that have proven already they're not the quality of the Premier League in terms of keeping a team up and keeping them safe. Guys like Cameron Jerome, Gary O'Neill, they're industrious, they'll work hard, they'll run around a lot. Have they got the quality required, though, to pick out a key pass or put the ball in the net consistently? The answer, unfortunately, is no, and Norwich are learning that the hard way, and I do feel sorry for their fans, because, again, this summer is going to be a huge summer for the clubs that maybe don't have as much financial pull or anything like that in terms of the TV deal. It could have been great for Norwich. It's not going to be now. They're going to have to go back down and rebuild again, which is unfortunate.
Karthik, Sunderland plays Everton, a game that if they win, I think they pretty much secure Premier League, that they stay in the Premier League. And the what's standing against them, if I remember correctly, is that they have a very poor record against Everton. I think they've won maybe one, maybe two games against Everton in the last 10 to 15 games. So, but having said that, we have discussed the failings of Everton and their manager. So given their brilliant result, that is Sunderland's brilliant result against Chelsea, do you see them securing Premier League, retaining a Premier League status after this game?
Well, I do, but I think the neutral on us all wants to see them drop points in this game so it's open for the final frenzied Sunday of the season, particularly if Norwich gets a win against Watford, which they very well might, mm-hmm. Playing at Carrow Road. So we'll see on this one. I mean, I think what we're finding from Sunderland is that they're very tidy at the back, although this was the one game they weren't, this game against Chelsea. But they're able to go forward and create chances. Now, creating chances against Everton usually leads to goals. And if Everton don't turn up as they did midweek, or they did on Saturday against Leicester, I mean, that's probably the least competitive 3-1 match I've ever seen in my life, right. The Leicester-Everton match. It just felt like a coronation, and one of these, they had brought a youth club out to have this celebration of the champions, right, yeah. That they could just kick around with. That's what it felt like.
I agree.
Yeah, no, and if Everton turn up that way at the Stadium of Light, then Sunderland will win it, and it'll be all over. The question, though, now is, so many of these Everton players are probably in the shop window. Stones, Lukaku, Barkley are the three you mentioned, maybe some others. Do they really want to go out with a whimper this season, or do they want to take one great last chance to put themselves in people's minds? Or is that what the Euros are for this summer?
Right.
Who knows?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I feel like we kind of forget that these players at the end of the day realize that they're going to be wanted by big clubs regardless. So I don't think they're going to worry too much about how they play against Sunderland, unfortunately. I think a lot of these players are looking ahead to the Euros and making sure they don't get injured. I think that's what it looked like when I saw Lukaku play against Leicester, for sure. The team that's
right, Belgium has a lot of injuries, so right, exactly. He's probably wanting to stay fit for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Leicester plays Chelsea, the team that Sunderland beat, Chris. When we were previewing that game, we were wondering which Chelsea will show up, because they had had a brilliant result the previous week. And then had a very a poor game, I guess, against Sunderland, the fact that they lost. So in this game, Liverpool will be heavily rotated, as we know, as Klopp has been trying to do. He's trying to bring in lots of young players and keep the main players out of firing range so they don't get injured. And for Chelsea, a little more at stake, in terms of pride. We know John Terry will be missing. His Chelsea career is over. So talk to me about Liverpool-Chelsea, Chris.
I think Kartik said it before we started. This is probably the first time in a long time that this game has had nothing really riding on it.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing actually other than pride to play for. I think, again, we talk about the rotation. Shay Ojo, who's come in quite recently for Liverpool during some Premier League games, I've been very impressed with him. He was at, I think, Wolves last year for a little loan spell. And he looked very good there as well. Very physical, very powerful. Reminds me a little bit of another quite promising youngster, Oliver.
I almost thought you were going to say a great tactician, the way Brendan Rodgers would have said it.
He's full of character.
Full of character.
He reminds me a little bit of Olivier Nisham, the Man City youngster who's at Genoa in the minute as well. Kind of a very big, powerful player who can play wide or centrally. Again, I think from a Liverpool perspective, this is a great opportunity to really evaluate the squad, because I think Klopp can almost just excuse the end of the Premier League season as him being on a bit of a fact-finding mission. They've got the Europa League final to play for. I think, again, if he loses that, we can discuss that another time. But at the minute, he's just trying to evaluate everyone in the squad, because obviously we've seen Jordan Rossiter leave, or it's being reported, I should say, in the Liverpool Echo, that he's going to sign for Rangers. So there's one youngster that was kind of on the fringes. It seemed he's gone. You've now got a space to potentially fill if you would like. So it's things like that that I think he'll try and learn with these games, because I was talking to some of the New York Red Bulls youngsters, funnily enough, about the big derby game they've got with DC United next weekend. And they both kind of agreed, the two lads, Alex Mule and Sean Davis, that those games are great because you really learn a lot about yourself and what you're like as a player and how you handle the pressure of the situation. That's what he'll be gleaming from this. And for Chelsea, unfortunately, all their youngsters are away on loan. So it's going to be a difficult one for Conte to try and assess in friendlies next season. If they can get Andreas Christensen back, I think they've got a potential replacement for John Terry already. I think Terry's actually said as much himself. The short term, though, it's deciding what you do with the big players. There's a lot less opportunity for Chelsea to decide those things right now because, again, it's going to be stuff that Conte will need to come in and sort.
Well, the thing about Christensen is, again, this shows Chelsea's policy. They've sent him out on a 2-year loan with, I believe, no recall clause.
That's crazy. I didn't even know you could do back-to-back 2-year. Well, I guess the United did with Falcao, didn't they? So 2-year loans. Wow.
Yeah, that's the bone of contention at the minute, is that essentially Gladbach have said he's not going anywhere. He's a big part of the team. His dad has said that he doesn't really know what's happening. Christensen himself says, I think fairly honestly and quite admirably, that he appreciates the opportunity that Gladbach have given him, and that if he's going to go back to Chelsea not to play, there's not a great, point in doing that. So again, it's very difficult because, again, Chelsea loan out so many youngsters to the likes of Vitesse and all these different clubs, and it just leaves you questioning how do you break into the first team when you're not playing at an elite club for the most part? You're playing either in a lesser league or a lesser team. It's just so difficult because even guys like Charlie Musonda, who has been, for the most part, I think quite impressive for Real Betis, mm-hmm. Where's his pathway to the first team? It's got to come with faith and consistency. I don't see that happening at Chelsea right now, so I hope Conte changes that.
Yeah, and Christensen is the one player they've loaned to a high-level club in a comparable league, and Mönchengladbach is better. It's a better team than Chelsea right now. And he's been an integral player, first-team player in that squad this season. So it's one of those things where, as we've seen with some other guys that Chelsea have loaned out or sold, that they don't actually value their players and their youngsters the way they should, the way that other people do.
Yeah, Karthik just very easily threw shade at Chelsea with that Mönchengladbach comment. That was amazing. The final game we need to preview, guys, is the West Ham United game. This is West Ham United versus Manchester United game. Manchester United, that is, will be missing Fellaini, and arguably that's a player that they could have used in this game, a combative player who can get around and defend on set pieces, which we know West Ham is very strong at, would probably hurt them. But what will hurt Manchester United even more, in my opinion, is the fact that we will almost definitely be missing Anthony Martial for this game, who got injured in the build-up to Saturday's game. So for me, guys, there's only one question that I want to ask you, and this is it for me. I think we will get a sense of how of Louis van Gaal's man management in this game, because at the end of the day, Manchester United know that if they win this game, they're pretty certain, because with Bournemouth being the final game, pretty certain to get the fourth place. And if United cannot show up for this game, if we see the same dross from United, I think it really goes back to Louis van Gaal. And Karthik, let me start with you on that. Are we good? We don't know what United will show up, but we know that we can interpret Louis van Gaal's ability to motivate this team depending on how United plays, even in the first half.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with your sentiment on that. I think this is a defining and judgment game for him, and it is the final Premier League match at a storied Premier League ground, the Bowling Ground, but there's all to play for Manchester United, and with the loss this week, there isn't all to play for West Ham, unless they're concerned about Europa League. You saw this season that they felt like exiting Europa League was probably better for their Premier League hopes, and it proved to be the case, than staying in that competition. So they may not put a great deal of value on the result in terms of where it puts them in the league, but they will certainly on the farewell to their ground as they prepare to move into the Olympic Stadium and potentially become one of the giants of English football with that stadium move. So all the pressure is on Van Gaal. This sets up nicely. And if he wins and United give a performance in the process, then he's probably safe. And you can say progress is made and tick a box. If not, then he very well could be judged harshly, especially if he doesn't win the FA Cup final. So I don't want to say that this is a job-deciding match for him, but it is probably a job-defining match for him.
Chris, we don't usually do score predictions on World Soccer Talk, but I'm going to have to ask you, score prediction for West Ham United, Manchester United.
2-1 Manchester United.
Karthik?
I'm going to say 2-2, unless there's some sort of remarkable defensive show from Manchester United. I think West Ham create chances, create opportunities. It's going to be a frenzied atmosphere. So I'm going to say draw.
Yeah, and I'm going to go with a West Ham win because I'm well aware of what Manchester United has been doing under Van Gaal, and also my lack of a belief in the fact that Louis Van Gaal will be able to motivate his players at all. At the end of the day, my take is if you want a team of 11 robots to win the Premier League or to play football, you want Louis Van Gaal as your manager. But if you want human beings, he might not be the best man for the job. In order to review those games and preview the final weekend of the Premier League, join us midweek as myself and probably Gabe Smith or two of the gentlemen tonight will be joining you. If you want to get in touch with us with questions and comments, find Chris at khanaj, Karthik at kkfla737, me at NipunChopra7, and World Soccer Talk at WSoccerTalk. Until then, on behalf of the gaffer, Chris Harris, Kristen Henaj, and myself, Karthik,
enjoy your football.